News Radio 1120 KPNW. Good morning. All right. We talked about this, man, it is well over a year ago, and it was a law that was passed during the Oregon legislative session. I believe it was either 2005 or 2024. I believe it was 2025. And it set up this thing that was called Oregon's Extended Producer Responsibility Recycling Law, which we're just going to shorten to EPR. Now, what it did was it required producers of packaging, paper goods, food service ware to register with a state-approved recycling organization and pay fees. And as you can imagine, there were, well, just about every producer of this stuff. Because look around you. Everything literally that is a product comes with packaging. Not to say the least, there were a lot of people that were fuming about this. And there was a court case where a judge issued an injunction and a stay. But do you think Oregon decided to stay stuff? Well, let's talk about it. Nick Johnson joins us on the wake-up call. He is a attorney, senior counsel with Foley and Lardner, and he is a member of the firm's Environmental Regulation Practice Food and Beverage Industry team, and he joins us on the wake-up call. Good morning, Nick. Thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Right. So what we were talking about with the EPR, it was Oregon Senate Bill 582, which set up the Recycling Modernization Act. And my question to you would be, can you give us a little bit of a background and maybe a better explanation of what this thing was supposed to do and kind of the structure of it?
Yeah. So SB 582, or Oregon's Extended Producer Responsibility, or EPR law, as these laws have come to be known, it's essentially a recycling law, and it is intended to shift more of the cost and responsibility for packaging waste from taxpayers and local governments to the companies that make and sell the packaged products. And this model has been used in Europe for quite some time and has recently migrated over to the United States. Oregon's law is getting a lot of press at the moment because it was sort of first past the post for many of the key deadlines in terms of being operationalized. But the policy consideration is, instead of cities and counties, local governments bearing most of the cost of dealing with packaging waste, the law requires the producers of the packaging, in some cases food service ware, single-use food service products, to help fund and manage an enhanced recycling system. So practically speaking, it requires companies who are producers of consumer goods, especially branded ones, to join what's called a Producer Responsibility Organization, or PRO, in an organ that's the Circular Action Alliance. Essentially report how much covered material, packaging material, that they sell into the state of Oregon, and then pay fees based on the volume of those materials that then are used to help finance recycling infrastructure and additional collection systems. And it at bottom, that is how the law works, or is intended to work.
Okay. So, just kind of looking at that from a distant view, that would be an insane job trying to figure out how much of your packaging goes to Oregon, wouldn't it?
It certainly is difficult in many cases, and that is one of the challenges that I have been helping our clients sort out. In some cases, producers do have good sales data that they can break down by SKU, that they can get information from their suppliers, right, their packaging suppliers, about the volumes of materials. And because the fees are calculated by weight, you know, there are some metrics that you can use and to actually calculate the volume of packaging materials. And in some cases, the PRO, the Circular Action Alliance, allows you to make certain assumptions about sales data. But to answer your question, yes, it is a significant lift, and it gets more significant the more SKUs you have and the more volume of products that you sell into the state of Oregon. Absolutely.
What are the penalties if you say, I'm not paying your fee?
It's a little bit of an interesting structure because the Circular Action Alliance is an NGO, and the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, which has enforcement authority, the statute essentially outsources administration of the program to the Circular Action Alliance, but the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality retains enforcement authority, the statute does have significant penalties. In some instances, they can be up to $25,000 per day per violation. We have not seen any, or at least I'm not aware of, any statutory enforcement yet. But to be clear, the penalties on the books can be very significant.
Okay. Are there any carve-outs in this EPR law? I mean, like based on, say, the size of producer, and I'm thinking, okay, you've got a small farm stand and they're selling jams and jellies and jars or things like that. I mean, are there carve-outs for any of these companies that use packaging?
Yeah, there are. So there are small producer exemptions. And the most important one is that there's a small producer exemption based mainly on annual revenue, and then the amount of covered material sold into the state. So if you're a company and you have gross global revenue, and so the important part about that is not just your revenue in the state of Oregon, but throughout the country, if your gross global revenue is less than $5 million for the most recent fiscal year, or if you have sold into Oregon less than one metric ton of covered products, then you are exempt from the law. So certainly, you know, small producers, farm stands, you know, small businesses, think your Etsy sellers and people like that, you are most likely and not covered by the law based on those sales thresholds. But I do want to emphasize that, you know, again, $5 million, at least for a lot of companies, is really not that much money because, again, the state measures it on gross global revenue. And one metric ton of covered products is hardly anything. And so the important thing is that, you know, for producers, if you think you may be covered, don't, by the law, don't guess. Consult an attorney if you need to. But yes, there are small producer exemptions.
So do they... let's say I'm one of those guys that owns one of those farm stands that we're talking about, and I have a fairly large one. I mean, I can think of a couple here in our regional area that, well, I could see maybe they would sell a metric ton of stuff a year. Do they have to file some sort of exemption form? I mean, do they have to fill out a bunch of forms to send in and say, hey, I'm a business and I'm exempt? Or, you know, I mean, do they have to do that?
Yeah, not necessarily. So the way the law works is that if you are obligated, you first, this is why it's so complicated. You first of all have to figure out yourself whether you're a covered producer or not, right? Either you or with the assistance of an attorney. If you are a covered producer, then your next obligation is to register with the Circular Action Alliance. you don't necessarily need to file anything if you believe, based on your analysis of the law, that you are not a covered producer, but you would want to have that determination, you know, living somewhere in your files, so that if either the Circular Action Alliance or the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality inquires as to whether you should be registered, which they have been doing, they've been sending letters to certain producers saying, hey, we think you should be registered under this law, then you are prepared to give them a reason why legally you believe you are not required to register.
Okay. I'm just going to throw in a side here, Nick. You're not saying this. I'm saying this to make it clear. This is one of the examples that businesses use of why it is so difficult to do business here in Oregon. Okay, that's my aside. You didn't say that. I said that, just so you know.
There's a reason why laws like this are making my phone ring, because it really is a trifecta of circumstances. It's an entirely new type of compliance obligation, right? We haven't seen laws like this in this country before. It's extremely complex. It does require quite a bit of internal resources, whether you're a small business or a large business. And it's been implemented very, very quickly, very quickly. And all of these things, again, if you're a lawyer, that sort of uncertain atmosphere is the type of thing that makes your phone ring, right? So yes, I mean, it is a new compliance obligation that's really taken some time for businesses to sort out.
Nick, I have a quick question. Are other states watching Oregon, do you think? Watching it closely?
They're certainly watching let me back up. There are six other states that have these laws in place. They are all in various stages of implementation, but again, Oregon was first to the post. It was first to the post to require producers to register, first to the post to make them pay fees in. And so I think states are very closely watching the litigation that has been filed, right, by the producer organization that has filed a constitutional challenge to this litigation, because if the plaintiffs have any measure of success, there are significant implications for the other state laws.
Yeah.
So yes, I think a lot of eyes are on Oregon right now and its EPR law, from regulated industry to other regulators in the state, to other interest groups, right? Yes, the show is in Oregon right now, I will tell you that.
Yeah, great. Okay, so the suit brought against this was brought by the National Association of Wholesale Distributors. They took it to federal court. Briefly, what did they argue, and what was the outcome of that?
Sure. Yep. So, I mean, the core argument of the lawsuit filed by the NAW was essentially that the law places financial and operational burdens on companies that are involved in interstate commerce, and particularly companies that are outside of the state of Oregon. So the NAW is a group of wholesalers and distributors, right? And so their claim was that the law particularly burdens that type of industry because they don't actually design or control the packaging involved that is regulated under the law. And so one of their, and here's your, here comes your legal lesson for the day.
Okay.
One of the main claims under the lawsuit was what's called the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is a constitutional concept that is rooted in the notion that a single state can't unfairly burden interstate commerce or effectively regulate business activity occurring outside of its borders. The plaintiffs also argued that because there were due process problems, right, constitutional process, due process, because the fee-setting process was opaque It is in part controlled by the producer responsibility organization itself, and that it lacks sufficient government oversight and transparency, including the ability to functionally challenge the fee-setting mechanism or any producer assessments that flow from that fee-setting mechanism. And those arguments were convincing enough that the federal judge overseeing the case issued a preliminary injunction early this year blocking the state from enforcing the law only against NAW and its members. And judges typically issue preliminary injunctions when they believe there are significant enough concerns with the legislation that it is worth issuing relief to the plaintiffs who have challenged the law. But for everyone else, not before the court, the law remains in effect. And that is simply a function of courts are also reluctant to issue nationwide injunctions broadly. And so where things sit right now, trial is scheduled for July. And again, there are a lot of people very interested in what the outcome of the trial will be.
But even though they put a stay on that, Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality has actually intensified its efforts to try and enforce the law. It's declined to refund prior fee payments, and it's issuing warning letters. Is that true?
That is true. And I think the departments, I can't speak for ODEQ, obviously,
sure.
But I think that ODEQ's posture is that the law remains in effect for the remainder of the regulated producers. The agency has compliance and enforcement obligations, and they will continue to do that. I think they also there's always an issue of stepped enforcement approaches with agencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing is consistent with that, right? They're not automatically obtaining injunctions or bringing enforcement actions against alleged violators. They're issuing warning letters, right, that give the regulated industry time to come into compliance. But yes, I mean, that's true. It's all systems go for anyone who's not subject to the preliminary injunction.
Now, didn't OBI, Oregon Business and Industries, didn't they try to be a part of this particular suit and somehow weren't involved in it? Or is that?
Yeah, there were several instances where trade groups asked to intervene before the court. That this is a concept of permissive intervention, where you can ask if you believe your interests are not being adequately represented in a lawsuit, you can ask the court to intervene, but the court does not have to grant that intervention. And in this instance, the court decided. I think the judge here is very, very focused on moving this case toward trial in July, because I think the judge well knows that the outcome here is going to have national implications. And so anytime you let additional parties in, you have to give them a certain ability to file briefs, right, to file appearances, to conduct discovery, and all of that slows down the litigation. And so my sense is, the judge is not inclined to allow additional parties in simply because they believe they can resolve the merits of the case with the parties who are currently existing to the litigation and just doesn't want to delay trial any further.
Okay. If the judge, now this is very hypothetical, in July, let's say the judge says, no, this, you can't do this. This is not constitutional. Sorry, it's done. Would the DEQ or the Circular Action Alliance be required to pay the money back that people have already paid into it? Or would the judge actually, in his decision, have to say, "And oh, by the way, you got to pay all these people back"?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. And because it's really a complicated question. And I think even if even if there were a ruling on the constitutional merits that struck all or part of the law down, a lot of whether producers would get their fees back or not, I think would really depend on the basis for the ruling. Mm-hmm. In some instances, whether the companies paid under protest, which is a legal concept, and how the court, and really what the court decided to structure the remedy as, right? So,
yeah.
Courts sometimes just limit relief prospectively, meaning that they stop future enforcement, but they don't necessarily undo everything that's already happened. And then there's also the reality here that a lot of the fees that have been paid have already been spent, right? So the Circular Action Alliance has used much of the fees paid so far for program implementation, right? They have nearly 200 employees. They have their own program costs. And then some of it is, you know, has been either allocated or transferred to the local state governments, right? So there's a question of, well, where's the money going to come from, even if it's ordered to be refunded? So I don't think anyone can count on that. Is how I would answer that question.
Well, it sounds to me, honestly, that if you are a producer, it might be a decent idea to contact an attorney.
Yes. and I realize that you got an attorney saying that. But, the one thing I will emphasize is that there are legal strategies, one of which is paying under protest, which is a concept by which you pay a fee, but you essentially claim that you've done it. Basically, you've been forced to do it. Based on an unenforceable law, but that's also something that's very difficult to establish, and it really, really depends on the facts of the case and where you are procedurally as a producer. But if you believe your rights may be affected by the outcome of this litigation, I would contact a trusted attorney who could advise on it.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, and, you know, going forward, if you have any hopes of getting any money back that you've already paid, probably would be definitely a good time to talk to your lawyer to see what your rights are, I guess, correct or incorrect.
Yeah, no, I would do it now before the outcome of the case, because, depending on the ruling, it may be too late by that point.
All right. Nick, we appreciate your time. Nick Johnson is a senior counsel with Foley & Lardner, and his expertise is, well, environmental regulation practice, food, and the beverage industry. We want to thank you for being on the wake-up call this morning. Thank you so much, Nick.
I really appreciate it, Bill. Great to be here, and thanks for the invite.
Yeah, absolutely. Our pleasure. Nick Johnson on the wake-up call this morning, and again, kind of like I said earlier, you know, this is why that people complain that Oregon is such a state filled with animosity towards businesses, and why it is so difficult for businesses to keep running in this state, and why businesses don't want to move to the state of Oregon. And there you have it, courtesy of just one bill. It is News Radio 1120 KPNW. Thanks for joining us this morning on the Wake Up Call.